I'm Christine George, and other than having at one time been a kid myself and have gone through the usual defining of limits with my parents, also in the last few years, I've been working first for a women's health organization, where a lot of young people would call up our organization. We had a hotline for access to health care, and it brought up a lot of interesting questions. I don't have a lot of answers for them, some of which I want to share with you in discussion tonight, and also that I work for an agency now that is concerned with advocacy and education around teen pregnancy, which also brings up some of these questions. So these issues keep on coming up a lot, and so that's where my interaction has been a lot. But my subtitle was Democracy in the Family. If you think of the family as an institution, like, you know, any other institution, the question of democracy and power within that institution is clearly, you know, how much is it a benevolent dictatorship, and how much is it a democracy? And I listed here a bunch of issues that have come up to me just sitting down and that have hit me on the issue, and then I'll go through a little background, a little historical background, and then I really want to open this after about 15 minutes to, you can cut me off before then and start asking questions, but to a lot of discussion on certain issues. A lot of people in the last 20 years, I mean it's been before that, have looked at rights, the rights of minorities in this country and other countries, the question of the rights of women. And another issue has been the question of discrimination based on age, called ageism. And a lot of people looking at our society think that there is discrimination on both ends of the sort of, whatever you want to call it, scale, that in terms of the very young and of the old, that there's a sense of patronizing, a sense of people not having rights, them not knowing what's best for themselves. So this issue has come up more and more. There are many books, you know, like the thing I passed out is one of many books on the subject. It is a legal question that is growing, and if your sons are lawyers, they're in training for very lucrative careers on this subject. And it comes up, I want to give you an example. When I work for this women's health organization in Illinois, there is a law of confidentiality in terms of young people and health care. So if a young woman wants, for example, to have an abortion, her parents do not have to be informed. In some states, for example, in Minnesota and Massachusetts, the parents have to be informed, but the question of what if the parents say no, the courts then decide. And there's a whole bunch. There were two Supreme Court cases last year. There'll probably be another Supreme Court case this year on this issue. And it keeps on coming up and up again and again. And we'll get into a couple of the permutations of that because it's a fascinating question. Even just of health care. If a 12-year-old goes to the doctor, does the doctor have a responsibility to tell the parents? Should the doctor be able to treat that 12-year-old? Or a 17-year-old. Why does it seem one way for a 12-year-old and another way for a 17-year-old? Legally, they are in the same position in terms of rights. So that whole question. The other area, other than healthcare, that this comes up a lot and has come a lot for me is the whole question of abuse, of children being in abusive relationships. When is their testimony something that can be heard of? Do they get special rights in testifying because we have to protect them, and therefore the lawyer shouldn't be able to cross-examine them in the same ways that they can cross-examine other witnesses? I'm just trying to say that's another whole issue where it's come up. The question, again, of a child thinking that they're in an abusive relationship and saying, I want another parent. I want another guardian. Or the society going and saying that. You know, who makes that decision? You know, and how you cut that kind of line. The other way that's a much more seemingly is the question of being hit by your teacher. You know, when I was young, I went to a parochial school, and the Greek language teacher had the ruler, and if we didn't do something right, he would hit us. And that was considered okay. Today, he would probably go to jail for that. You know, and is it all right? And what is it that that if I see a man or a woman behaving inappropriately on the street, my impulse is not to shake them or hit them. But often with a young child, you might have that impulse. And what is it? Could it be the question of that we're bigger, that we have a sense of power, that we think that we have some stewardship over? I'm just saying, it's a, again, that's another place where it comes out a lot. We talked of runaways and choosing parents, which had to do a little with the abuses. What rights do kids have to leave home? Then to the very mundane is that I live in, I have a summer home, and we have some children in that summer home. There's four of us families who own it together, and we have a rule that there is no television in the living room. Well, actually, there are 8 adults and 8 children who make use of this summer home. And obviously the adults, a couple who vacillate on the subject, but basically the adults say this is a dictatorship. We are saying no television. That is the last word. And we are told that we are not being consistent in our value system, and that they have just as much right to use of the place as we do, which at which point the conversation goes back to, we pay the mortgage and you don't. But I'm just trying to say that that is, again, in my day-to-day life, where it is where it comes up a lot. And the other last place is work. Children, most in this country, aren't legally, basically, except in certain situations, allowed to work when they're until they're 16. The question of what power they have over the money that they earn. You remember the movie stars in there was child protection laws which had to be developed because the young movie stars often their parents would use their money on them, and that when they became of age, that there was no money left, and their parents had used their money because it wasn't their money, it was their parents' money. To the question of a 14-year-old, should they be able to, if they have a child, should they be able to get welfare on their own, or do they have to have a guardian in order to receive that welfare? All those kind of questions of power. So those are the kinds of things, and have people seen other situations? I just listed a few, but are there other situations that people have seen in terms of the question of power? Or the question of rights in kids? If you run into other situations or read about them in the newspaper.
Well, the one I have had a hard time with is that when the kids run away from home, the parents can't make them come back. And that's caused a lot of trouble with people I know.
Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. I think that is a real key one, is runaways. Anything else? If people look, what is a child is part of the question. Partially they're politically disenfranchised. They have no political power. And they're also economically disenfranchised. They have no access to property or to money. For example, if a young child, a five-year-old child tomorrow inherited $1 million, they could not decide what to do with that $1 million. A guardian would have to be given. So they have no political or economic power, which are the things that make you a citizen and give you some power in this world. Their legal status, in fact, is passive. They are the property of their parents in many ways. In fact, it's interesting that I was talking to a woman who was in foster care, and she was talking about one of her foster care daughters, and she said, well, yes, and she said that she hadn't adopted them, but they gotten very close, and she says that was because she came to us and she was just about at the age of emancipation. And it's interesting that we use the word emancipation to describe when a child, it's usually 16, in some cases it can be younger, when the courts can emancipate a child and say, now you don't have to go back to your parents, now you could set up your own household. And you don't necessarily need a guardianship. That we use that word, I think, is real interesting.
Under 16,
what?
I thought it was under 16 in Washington State.
It could be. I'm talking. I gave Illinois as an example in terms of emancipation. Usually, emancipation is around 15 or 16, and there are some situations that are younger than that, but they have to be approved by the courts. But different states, some states which are considered more liberal, have lower emancipation ages than other states. So it could be that Washington State is more liberal or broader in that situation. Like, I don't know what the age of emancipation is in Canada, for example. The myth of children, there are two myths. One is that they are the central reason for a family's existence, and that parents exist to be stewards of the children, just as we're saying. The question is this real or is it a myth? Now, obviously, on one hand, it is real, just like farmers are stewards of the earth, but on the other hand, it's a myth because there are cases of abuse or children being treated like property, just like we aren't often very good stewards of the earth. But when people think of children and what's going to protect them, they think of the fact that there is something in our hormones and our ethics that is going to have us protect our children. And then secondly, that the other reason, the other thing we think of children is it's the best years of our lives. How often were we told that these were the best years of our lives? How often are the kids in these rooms, these are the best years, these are the golden years. This is the time of unconstrained freedom. You can play all you want. You'll spend your time learning and being educated. There's a question whether it is those golden years. I saw you shaking your head right there. How many people do you think that it's the best years of a person's life? It's the best year, the golden years.
I think they're pretty good.
I think it could be. It depends on your life.
I'm sorry, you're just...
I had a good time growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had a good time growing up too, but I couldn't say of any of the year of my life that it has been the best. I mean, I'm pretty young, but still I think being 20 and this is not childhood is great. I have a grandma who's 70, and she thinks it's great to be a grandma too.
That's good. Yeah. Whatever you happen to be is the best years of your life.
I think it depends. It's going to be different for everybody. For some children, their childhood is a horror, and for other children, they have a wonderful mm-hmm. childhood. Mm-hmm. Some adults have a terrible mm-hmm. time, and some mm-hmm. are enjoying retirement or whatever, and mm-hmm. I just think it depends on the individual.
Yeah. But for any kids, I think you have to go through some hard times being a kid. I mean, dealing with emotions and relationships with other people, kids and other kids, and not having any
friends. I think basically I think what we've said here is it can be a wonderful time, but it's really relative. It's relative to a lot of other things. Are you poor and starving in a third world country? It's likely not to be the best years of your life. Are you in an abusive relationship? All of those things obviously have to be taken into consideration. I think also it is important in that I've thought about a lot is when I thought of it as the best years, if we think of it just that way, you then deny the fact that there is a lot of pain involved. I mean, even in the best situation of great parents and ideal stuff, you know, it really hurts when your friendship group ostracizes you, and sort of the games that are played in, you know, late latency and early adolescence. And all those things are very painful in learning these things and so when there are really problems that really hurt, and then we're saying, oh, they're not real problems. When you get to be 30, then there'll be real problems. They hurt just as much as, you know, real problems. And because they are very real, you know, the pain of a 12-year-old and what's happening is in its place as painful as the pain of a 30-year-old or a 60-year-old. And I think that that's another kind of issue that we mask. By saying it's a golden age, we without looking at it critically, we then mask and don't respect enough the individual problems that the child might have. And by saying that every family is, as I say, the Ozzie and Harriet, I'm dating myself, family, leave it to Beaver, father knows best, is again saying that, you know, we don't have to worry. Everything will, you know, take care of itself. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's been different for a long time, and historically, I mean, there didn't used to be childhood many. In the Middle Ages and earlier on, if you even see pictures of kids, they're dressed like grown-ups. And there wasn't sense of childhood. As soon as the children could take care of themselves, they were put to work.
I wouldn't even go that far back. Maybe just 150 years.
It really depends. In some parts of the world, it is still that way. Usually, in the Western world, it's usually considered that around 400 years ago, in the 15 and 1600s, is when childhood came into being. When a child was considered somehow differently, okay, than before. But there are whole problems with considering children differently than before. To think that this is childhood and this is adulthood, and there's these two distinct differences. And the differences are what I want to talk about for a minute, and then I want to get back to those cases. One is the issue that it's not universal, okay? That what's childhood one place is adulthood another place. And that is, when you're looking at a different culture, even within this country, it was very interesting. We were dealing with the issue of teenage pregnancy. Most of us will say our culture will say that it's too soon for a woman of 14 to have a child. That's a parent too soon. That'll be what we'll be thinking. However, for instance, in the Hmong culture of the Cambodian refugees who live in uptown Chicago, that is not too young. That is the age in which it's arranged. So, you know, what do you do about that? I'm just saying, so there's different cultures, and if we're going to respect cultures, what does that mean? Secondly, saying that there are two ages is we're real inconsistent. For example, you can vote at 18. You are supposed to be sexually emancipated when you're 16. You're considered an adult when you're 16. And when are you a criminal? When do you get the death penalty? If you murder someone when you're 12, 11, is there a difference between a 12 and 13-year-old? In this country, there are people on death row right now who committed the murder when they were 13 years old. And that question is going to the Supreme Court. And different states, a lot of them southern states as opposed to northern states, have real different views on this issue. And how do we decide it? So, you know, so we're calling people adults different places and at different times. And I think that that is another real question. And also, there's a big difference between a two-year-old, a child who's 16, and a child who's 2. There's a difference. But legally, there isn't that much of a difference. The 16-year-old and the 21-year-old are a lot more similar. A 21-year-old is an adult, and a 16-year-old is still a child. And so all of those are different kinds of problems of when we look into the situation. Then to make the matters even worse, we have childhood now that we didn't have before. The other thing is, because of education and our economy and preparing to get into our society, childhood on some levels extends into the mid-20s. In terms of responsibility, yes, by the time you're 18, you can vote and get married and hold property and all those kinds of things. You can be drafted into the army. That was the argument, right, in terms of voting, was during the Vietnamese War. We're drafting young men at 17 and 18 and send them off to war, and yet they couldn't vote or they couldn't drink. And so then we lowered our drinking ages and we lowered our voting ages to 18. Now what's happening is we're deciding too many young people are immature and can't hold their liquor, so we're moving it up to 21 because we're having too many accidents. So they can vote at 18, but they can't drink until they're 21. So this question becomes cloudier and cloudier again. But as I say, you could be 23 and you're still in school. You've never, your parents are still supporting you, or the society is supporting you in terms of scholarships or various things, or you have a transient work, you're still preparing. In a lot of ways, you're still a child. You're still dependent. Even though you have some of the rights, you haven't assumed the productive responsibilities yet. And so childhood is becoming this thing, as I say now, which is broadening. It seems with historically, at least in Western industrialized world, childhood is becoming longer and longer. And the sort of the lines would say, here's a child, here as an adult are very fuzzy. You know, some people would say some people are still children when they're 30, right?
Some never.
Right. That's another issue.
71, I get rid of my child.
There's two views on rights. I'm at one of the view of all the people who are writing on this, and are people who are like libertarian, who think that, for instance, John Holt, he thinks children should be able to vote, work, own property, travel, choose one's guardian, be able to control one's learning, to drive and use drugs. I mean, this guy, I'm just saying that this is a writer who writes a lot about children and writes a lot about children who are being victimized, and he thinks children should decide everything for themselves. He thinks that they should be able to vote to decide.
At whatever age? At any age?
Well, I mean, he'll say appropriate age. He's a little fuzzy. You know, it's a philosopher, right? So, and then there are other people that say, when we're talking about rights, we're not talking about those kind of rights. We're talking about protective rights. They have a right to be warm. They have a right to have food. They have the right to be protected. And that if the government sees that or the society sees that the parent is not doing that, then society should step in. And that's a different kind of right. So on those two subjects, those are the two kinds of things that are going on. Someone who says that you have total rights, and someone who says that you just have protection. The protection's a lot easier, but it gets you into a lot of interesting situations. Like the situation of, in terms of protection, of what happens, does everybody agree that the appropriate place to raise children is in a family? Okay, everybody agrees with that.
In a family? Is that
under any circumstances?
In a family or in their own family?
Okay.
I'd like to change that.
It's not always in their own
family. Appropriate.
Yeah.
Okay.
The appropriate place is not always in the child's own family.
You mean the best place?
Ideally, it should be. But if you have parents that act inappropriately, then it's not the appropriate place for the child.
But aren't you talking about the family versus, say, a state-controlled organization, a co-op, where you take all the kids out to the government that run the co-op and say that's where they belong, rather than the family?
Well, but what's the difference between, we'll say, a co-op situation in which the society decides that, like, we'll say a kibbutz situation or something like that, which the society decides that all the children are going to be raised as a group. They might visit their blood parents, their birth parents on weekends and stuff like that. And what she's saying is that the government can decide you're not an appropriate parent and we can take the child away from you. Isn't that still giving the state or society the power as opposed to the parent? I mean,
I don't think not all adults make appropriate parents. Most do. I work for a program, the WIC program, which is, I work with low income people, and I see women, infants, and children that are all low income, and many of them that come in on clinic days act very inappropriately with their kids. And we're supposed to decide if we need to make public health referrals for families that are displaying poor parenting skills. And a public health nurse goes out and then evaluates whether she thinks that there's any kind of a problem in the home. You know, I see a lot of people who seem to act very inappropriately with their kids. I don't know what happens at home. I only see them for a very short time. You know, but I know a lot of horror stories, and I know that not every child belongs with their parent. Most do. You know, 99.9% do. But there's that real critical small percentage that should not be with their parents.
I agree with that.
You know, what's real interesting is a situation like this, is that someone comes into the WIC office, I mean, we're using that as an example, which is a nutritional program. Women, infants, and children, isn't it? It's a nutritional program that gives nutrition supplements to pregnant and lactating parents, is that it?
Mm-hmm. And children to age five.
And children to age five. and you see a situation of a dysfunctional and abusive situation, they aren't parenting the child correctly or whatever. And we know that children are precious, and we want them to have a golden age, and we want them to be able to grow up strong. And we know how a lot of people who do developmental psychology say the early years are very important, right? So then comes up the subject, what should the government do? And you also know that there are a number of people who want to adopt children. All right. So do you basically look at a family, and if you think it's not functioning, and you give it, we'll say, 6 months, you then take the child out and put the child up for adoption? Is that what you should do? Or should you put a lot of resources and allow 2 or 3 years? This isn't the reception that the government actually had the money and the will to do this. To try to build up that family and make it functional and take a gamble. I'm doing two extremes. What do people think? Which of those two extremes? How many people, just out of curiosity, how many people think the extreme of ship or, shape up or ship out? In other words, you do a 6 month thing and then try to place the child somewhere else.
Well, I feel that in a real critical situation, because in most of the situations that I see, in 6 months, a family is not going to pull themselves together, economically, emotionally, or whatever. If I see somebody come in, they're high on drugs, the mother claims she has no income, she's living in a hotel, they're eating off food off a hot plate, she's probably a prostitute, the children are not cared for, they come in dressed inappropriately for winter or whatever, I really give that family small chance that in 6 months they're going to pull themselves together. And even given all kinds of resources, and I've worked in clinic settings where we provide more than just vouchers for food, we're providing counseling, we're providing transportation to programs, and so on and so forth. Many of them just come with the attitude, give me everything you can, I'm not going to try and raise the level of my existence to something else. Some do. But in some situations, many that I see, they don't. And in that kind of case, I feel like there needs to be an advocate for that child.
Well, actually, we've seen some deaths lately in the Seattle papers, where they should have been taken away, and they end up dying.
Yeah, not long ago, we had a situation where I work now at the county program where a public health nurse was overly concerned about an infant placed in a home. The mother was emotionally imbalanced. She contacted Child Protective. They really dragged their feet, finally got in there, and when they did, the infant was barely alive, was gray, and was being fed formula with an eyedropper. Somebody has to come in and be an advocate there. That mother is not, appropriately, parenting the child. And again, in most situations, the parents are the right people for children to be with, but there are some cases where they're not.
Does anybody have the other end to say on that? I think it's just,
Well, I would say naturally, in the sense of from nature, the parents should be the own parents should be the one to raise their children. And I guess in our early ancestors, there weren't those problems that we have now with our high-tech technology society. So I would say, from that point of view, your own parents should be the ones who raise you. But I totally agree with her that when the parents can't even keep themselves appropriate, how should they be able to raise their children?
At the same time, the idea of shape up and ship out that's ridiculous. To say you've got 6 months and we'll take your child away, and that instant the child would have died. But otherwise, there's got to be a situation where there's a median, where a child in that situation can be taken, placed in a foster home for a period of time, and be cared for appropriately. and the parent given counseling and whatever assistance, and another chance, you know, and to have a hard line on something. I don't think that happens, I'm hoping it doesn't.
The problem I think many of us have with the question of the intervention of the state is just how much and when. And you can think of extreme cases. There's one case that went through the British Columbia Supreme Court recently of a child who had been taken into custody by the Social Services Ministry before he was born. And of course that immediately caused all kinds of... And shortly before she delivered, the Social Services Ministry came in and said that we're taking this child too.
There were some other extenuating circumstances though, because she was actually in labor when they did that.
Yeah.
And she was in a breech situation and the child was struggling to survive.
She was refusing
a cesarean situation.
That's right.
And so there was extenuating circumstances.
But the court decision determined that the state had actually intervened in the mother's rights as well.
Mm-hmm. As you can see, this is it's a fascinating, like, you know, the thing that you just said. What if there's been a woman who's had four children and she has each of the children appropriately been taken away, then do you wait for the 6 months or forever for the other child? You know, the other extreme of that, and I think what we're saying is that everything has to be done on individual cases and sort of really weighing everything judiciously, and sometimes we wonder how judicious bureaucracies often can be, which is part of the problem in this, is having a view of functioning that might be different. In other words, then maybe the child is getting love and is functioning. We're not talking about, you know, the situation, which is a very clear-cut one that you described, but another one that, but in fact, the mores of the general society say, well, this isn't functioning. This is a poor person. They're not being able to give them enough food. They're not going to get the quite, if someone adopted this child, they would get a lot better start in life. You know, and that whole question becomes very, very murky. So that, and that issue, I don't think, I don't think we've done a really good job. And what I think is the saddest part of this is a lot of children get stuck in a gray area in which they're getting bounced back and forth, you know, because it's the state or the society can't make a decision that they, on one hand, money isn't put into the family to prop it up in some ways or to do the kind of supportive services that might make it function. On the other hand, a clear-cut decision isn't made that the child should be put up for adoption, and so they live in this gray area of foster care for a number of years or going back and forth and lead a very insecure, unstable life. You know, and sort of fall through the holes until they're, you know, 11 or 10, and then finally a decision is made, and by that time often it's very hard to find a family who will adopt them or another situation. And so I think that I don't think we're handling this very well at all. Let's take another situation. And I'm going to take one that's emotion-laden, which is the issue of abortion. And this one plays itself many ways. There's the question of, does the young woman have the right to make a decision without even telling her parents that she can make is making a decision? Okay, does anyone think that a young woman has that right?
At what age?
Whatever age she becomes pregnant at. So it could be usually...
Still living at home, you mean?
Yeah. Okay. Whether
15 or 16.
Yeah. Like, for example, the state of Illinois...
A lot of them now are only 12.
Right. Yeah. The state of Illinois... I'm just giving you an example. The state of Illinois says yes, that there's total confidentiality, that if I'm a doctor and a 12-year-old comes to me and says that and she's pregnant, she wants to terminate that pregnancy, I cannot call up her parents and tell her.
Well, why don't you want to call the parents to make them allow it or to inform them about the situation of the child? I mean, that's different, isn't it? I mean, you could want to inform the parents to make them watch over their child in a different way if it's a 12-year-old. Or to punish it, or to keep the child and raise it? What do they hope for telling the parents?
I guess that brings up the question, what are the rights of the parents to become grandparents? Mm-hmm. They have a right to say, I want that grandchild or not. The one that's pregnant is their child. But who has the right then?
Or my thought on that is, at what point, you know, the parents' responsibility. If the parents are going to have to come up with the money for this abortion, or if things go wrong and that child is still the responsibility of the parents, and the parents are going to have to pick up that bill, then I feel the parents should be informed. They should know what's coming instead of saying, well, we made all these decisions, but tough, this is now your responsibility.
If the state is willing to give this girl counseling 15 years down the road if she needs it at their expense, that's one thing. But they won't. They'll come back to the parents who are going to pay for that. Or the child themselves can be paying for that.
But in either situation, if they had the abortion or not, I mean, they still might need the counseling.
True.
Mm-hmm. I know there are situations where it's a terrible relationship with the parents, and, you know, a parent might say, we're going to punish you, you're going to have this baby, no matter what. I mean, it can be really... really terrible either way. I mean, I would hope that, you know, our own relationship would be good enough that there would be that, you know, talking about a terrible situation. But I know sometimes that it can be impossible if the parents are told, and it would ruin the life of the poor young kid that's pregnant.
Well, you're talking about rights of people who can speak. How about the rights of the unborn?
But that, I would say, is a different question. What I'm saying is, I think that's a question whether you think there should be abortion legal or not legal throughout society. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you that that's an issue for a number of people, but I'm saying, assuming that it's a little more it's even more complicated in some ways. I mean, that adds another layer of decision making. I agree. You know,
it's whether you view the unborn as a person.
But again, and the question, that's part of it, and it's off. So that's one issue: the rights of the possible future life or the future life, depending on what your belief is about that. Then you have the question of if the parents believe if the grandparent, future grandparent, you know, we're talking to, and the pregnant child's beliefs are different, who should win? Whose beliefs, do you see what I'm saying?
Or the third factor, not so long ago, there was a situation where the father-to-be said, I want that child. I want the mother to have it, and I will totally be, financially responsible.
Yeah, but in the state of Washington, at least when a relative of ours adopted a baby not too many years ago, the boy responsible was not going to support the child, but he is still given 31 days to keep that child or to say it's his and he wants it, whether he supports it or not, mm-hmm. before they can adopt him. So
I've had situations, it's interesting, because I thought all the situations I would run into on this hotline, you know, when people would call in, would be situations of the young, and as I said, this was a case where there was confidentiality. I mean, the law said that there was confidentiality, but it would be situations in which the young woman would want to terminate the pregnancy and was afraid that the parents would disagree with that. I actually ran into other situations in which there was that case, and there was the other, that the parents were saying and were using coercive means to tell the young woman to terminate when the young woman wasn't willing to make that situation. You know, and so it really brings up an interesting question of property.
You know, the boy responsible too can stop an abortion in some cases.
Right. Or for example, there was a case it was either Indiana or Michigan. I can't remember. I know it was the state just east of Illinois, and there are two states just east of Illinois, in which a young woman who was, I believe, a ward of the court, although she was living with her mother's. I can't remember the exact situation, but somehow the court entered into the situation. And she was pregnant because of sexual assault. And what happened in that situation is that the judge said that she was asking for it, and she was 12 years old at the time, and said that she had to go through with it. And what happened is, by the time it got up the judicial process, it was too late.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was no longer an issue. So that's another interesting question. It's a question of when you make decisions about yourself, or do you let other people make those decisions for you, is basically where it comes in. Right. But then does that mean if that pregnant girl is 12 years old and you are the grandparents and you disagree with that you are now legally responsible to support both of them until she's 18? Because there are now laws like in Wisconsin which say that if you are a parent of a teenage parent, that you are responsible financially on both sides, both the paternal and the maternal grandparents are responsible for that young family until they both reach majority. Whether you agree or don't agree,
question.
Yeah.
Don't most states have laws that say how long you are responsible financially for your children?
Well, it seems what's happened is no. They do and they don't. Mm-hmm. In other words, it was clear that when a child has a child, that some states would say that event emancipated them. And then meant that the parents, the grandparents, no longer had responsibility, and so that their new family could then fend for themselves or go on welfare. And
in that unique situation, or are there other? Because my question just is, we have run across several cases of acquaintances and so forth where a child would maybe be about 15, decides that this family obviously is ruining their life, we don't like our parents, we want somebody else. And, you know, goes down to some social worker, gets taken out of the home, put in another home, and the parents have to foot the bill.
Right.
How long are you legally responsible for your child?
Usually 18.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying.
But I'm saying that, but some states would, but what it was is that some states were very unclear if there weren't certain acts, which in fact would emancipate. And that was one of them. And so then it was very fuzzy. And that when there were court cases to go for the grandparents to pay for the parents and the young child, I always have trouble with these three generational families. I mean, they would lose. So then, what happened in Wisconsin and some other states that they therefore created this law called grandparent deeming to make it very clear that the welfare department had the legal right to go after the grandparents to get back the money that the welfare department was paying off. Very similar to cases in which a man and woman are divorced and the man isn't paying his child support, and then the woman ends up on welfare. The welfare department can go after the man in order to do it, and they wanted to create that same kind of legal situation. Well, right now, in the United States, in Congress, that they're looking at welfare law, and they're saying that if you're a young parent, younger than 18, or in some cases younger than 21, and you want to be on welfare, you can't get on your own welfare grant. You have to live at home with your parents, and your parents' income has to be taken into consideration to determine if you're eligible for welfare or not. And a lot of people are fighting that because they're saying that obviously that the best of all situations is that the three generations can live together, but often it's an abusive or a bad situation to begin with, and then you're forcing a dysfunctional situation, which you're going to create as a homelessness of those who will run away. They can't get on welfare. They can't get, you know, they aren't supported by the grandparents. And so it's creating that kind of situation. So, but let's talk about something a little less heavier. I mean, these are, those are the hard ones we've talked about. We'll talk about one more hard one. I mean, we've talked a little bit about abuse. Let's talk a little bit about corporal punishment. Let's talk a little bit about hitting.
Is spanking on behind considered abuse? Or is that just a correctional measure?
The floor is open.
How high do you think?
You know, it's like a canoe, they act better if they're paddling the rear.
Well, how high do you think?
On the other hand, all right, what other people think?
I didn't get it.
if you're trying to correct a child and you can't reason with them, but if you spank them a couple of times, they kind of get the point.
On the rear.
Down the rear, down the bottom. Is that corporal punishment or not? And that's what depends on how hard you hit, or how many times you spank or something.
Or what for, or,
yeah.
You know, how do you come up with a rule on that? It's so, there are no two situations ever alike.
Do you imprison the child in a cage rather than spank him, or is that abuse? You know.
And some people think that that's a proper thing to do. I mean,
you send them to your room for 2 hours.
Right, and they demolish it because they're upset with you or something.
The definition of corporal punishment means physical, doesn't it? Some kind of physical impact.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about verbal, too, because that can be pretty damaging.
Yeah.
But I was just doing physical. You know, it's interesting to leave this for a second, and let's talk about women and men within a family. That I come from a culture that a very patriarchal European, Southern European culture, that definitely in my mother's generation, definitely my grandmother's generation, it was not considered inappropriate for a man to beat up his wife for corrective measures.
And what constitutes beating him up, beating her up?
It could be pretty severe.
Like with a club or something?
Right. I mean, if he went too far, the society would frown on it, but considered that he had the right to do it.
Well, he did have, you said.
He did have the right to do it.
Oh, he did.
And I can even remember at weddings when I was small, and it was a joke, and you, I'm sure, remember, in which the husband, at the shower or something, would be given a paddle.
No, I didn't ever see that.
Oh, well, okay. Now if that happened even within the culture I'm brought up in, it would be considered weird. But I'm just saying that really values have changed on that issue. Examples of a husband would be hitting his wife and go to the priest, and the priest says, you are to, you know, obey your husband. You made a vow to obey your husband.
That's why you said obey.
Obey your husband?
Is that
what
you
say
when
you say
obey?
Just say obey, but I never really knew why.
And the only reason I'm bringing this up, which is a whole other discussion, which is, you know, when now it's culturally unacceptable to do it, and in fact we think it's a dysfunctional family that happens in, and we talk about battering and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But and so then if we take it to children, we have that also issue's been coming up. It used to be a very common thing for kids to be hit in schools, and now a teacher will go. The teacher can be beat up, and the kid can't be beat up in the schools, right? In some of the heavy schools, and now that's an issue.
With drastic results.
With drastic results.
For as far as obedience in school and not disrupting the class is concerned. The kids need a little correction like that, I think, that they used to get in school. That we didn't have, when I was in school, we didn't have that kind of attitude that they have today.
Well, there's a lot of teachers that my sons have been through with classes that I surely wouldn't have wanted them to have the permission to get the paddle. I mean, there's others that, you know, well, perhaps that would have been a corrective measure. Yeah. But I would say there's several that there's no way I would have trusted them.
I would say a teacher that is not able to keep a class in order and to teach a class without punishing him physically is not to be a teacher.
I would agree with you, accepting that now in the United States, where everybody's mainstream, you've got kids It shouldn't be in a regular class that are just totally disruptive.
I work in the school system. I think that's a naive statement.
Teachers have their hands tied, absolutely tied.
Those kids are so, they're so on to drugs to keep them keeping going emotionally, and the only, you know, the teachers are not allowed to strike them, and the only alternative is to send the child out of the room because they just...
Well, that's not to have a punishment.
Total, yeah, but I mean, the situation is such that it certainly isn't a reflection on the teacher to be able to keep order in the classroom, you know.
But in a...
And the sad thing is, some of the kids that are so angry is because of the home situation. They're just boiling over with anger because of situations at home.
She may be talking about older children.
Fourth grade.
Well,
sixth grade and, you know, that type of thing. And that's the thing, too. It's progressing further on down. And so I think it's one of society's great ills at this point.
But you know what's really interesting?
Well, you know, I hate to leave, but I'm going to have to.
Yeah, we are. We're all going to have to go. I just want to say to close up. What's interesting about this a lot of that is that we only think of using corporal punishment to a person that we don't think who is equal to us, but who is less than us, who has less power. And we don't think of using it, you know, as I say, to someone who is equal to us. Like if someone is behaving very inappropriately, he is the pastor of your church and he is behaving very inappropriately, you don't think of going and spanking him or hitting him. I'm just trying to say, so there's a real interesting view.
It's not just less power, it's less knowledge. I mean, if my three-year-old continues to put his head in the oven, you know, there's a reason.
We're pulling a rock in
his system. Yeah. It's not just power, it's their ability to understand dangerous situations for themselves or someone else. You know, I mean, we spank our kids, and hopefully we do it at the appropriate time and not when we're the ones, you know, angry and all of that. Hopefully we use it at the right time. But, you know, for me, it's real hard to come up with a way for a young child to understand not to do something very dangerous. You know, put him in his room and he sits down and plays with Legos. Well, that's real punishment for my kid, you know.
Well, we have to actually end this. This is official. But I just want to say, I think this it's a continuing conversation. I think it's easier, although on the hard issues, but stuff like this.
And he lost the padlock.
I'll tell you what, it's third person too. When you're talking about, you know, your teenage child getting an abortion, that you don't have to be personalized. But when you're talking about giving your three-year-old a spot on the bottle,
right? No, it really
hold the heart is there.
Right, and as you say, when nothing else communicates, and you have a sense of responsibility as teaching, is that what you do? I mean, I don't have an easy answer for this.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.